She's the Rashi Yeshiva. It's a great honor for me to introduce our guests today. Just to put a little bit in the frame of reference, many years ago, maybe Rabbi Twersky will remember how many, when I was young and he was younger, I had just come from St. Louis to New York. I became the rabbi of Young Israel of Hillcrest, and I had the great ambition to make the adult education program of the Young Israel of Hillcrest the best in the New York area. And at that time, I had the great idea, the lucky idea, to invite Rabbi Twersky to become a member of the faculty of the adult education of Young Israel of Hillcrest. And I spoke to the people who took Yeshurim. I will now express. I found out two things essentially, and I'll use it in terms of Dafka, one of the yesterday's Kriyat HaTorah. We read Pasha Shkalim Kitisa. Now Kitisa has many translations, counting, but one of the translations of Kitisa could also mean elevating and transforming. And what bar none, the students who attended those Shirim told me about the transforming nature of Rav Twersky Shirim. And when I started to contemplate how come, it occurred to me that perhaps there's another element of that, of his shir. Kitisa also comes, the Tav Shin Aleph also comes from the Ke'elov Noseis Nafsho. In other words, not only transforming and elevating and counting, it also means longing. Because when somebody gives a shir, of course you need the erudition, and you know, of course you need the knowledge, and you know, you really have to know everywhere. But somebody has the blessed ability of making you not only learn, but longing for learning, looking out, learning all of a sudden is a goal, is a rapture. It's somehow, and if you learn Torah from that kind of person, not only do you learn Torah from that kind of person, but it transforms you. And that's why he was that kind of Rebbe, not only by us, but also, of course, for so many years, and wishing for many more years in Yeshiva University. It's a great honor to be exposed to the thought of Rav Twersky and have Rav Twersky lecture to us.
Thank you very much, Avikas. Shusha Rabbanim Rashi HaYeshiva. It was suggested that we talk a little bit about the Chibur Chofshis. There are many different aspects to the topic, so maybe we'll try to touch upon a few different elements, a few different dimensions of the topic. And as so much else in Torah learning, as is true of so much else, we'll begin with a couple of halachas in the Rambam. So if you have the Xerox sheet in front of you, maybe we'll just begin by reading a little bit, and then use this as a springboard a little bit for some discussion. Rishos l'chol adam nesuna. So we usually, Rishus means permission. In this context, it doesn't mean permission. It means much more than permission. It means the capacity, the ability. Rishus l'chol adam nesuna, the capacity and ability is given to every person. If a person wants to incline himself, wants to put himself on the track of good and to be righteous, he has that ability. On the other hand, in Ratzalahatos Atzmal the Derech Ra'a V'liyos Rasha Rishos B'yado, if a person so chooses, then he can root himself along the path of evil, and he can be a wicked person. Rachman Litzlan, Hu Shekosu V'Torah Hein Ha'odam Hoya Ka'achad Mimenu V'Das Tova Ra. So the Rambam understands this pasuk. Not all understand it this way, but the Rambam understands this pasuk. This pasuk is said in the aftermath of Adam having eaten from the Eitz Hadas, from the tree of knowledge. Someone shot in this pasuk, Hein HaAdam, now Adam, post Chet, after having sinned, has become ka'achad mimena ladas tovera. The Rambam didn't. There's a three-volume work on the Rambam Hilchos Tshuva called Sefer HaTshuva. So I think the author of that work points out that the Rambam clearly understands this pasuk. Hein ha'adam hoya ka'achad mimenu means that Adam, from the time he was created, is unique in that he knows tov v'ra. Kloma hein min zeh shel Adam. This species of man, hoya yachid ba'olam, he's unique. V'ein min sheni domelo, and in the world there's no comparable creature. For zeh ha'inyan. Now let's pay special attention to these next few words, Rabbi Osai. Sheyehehu me'atzmo b'dayto u'b'machshavto yodeya hatov v'hara v'ose kol mashehu chafetz v'ein misha ya'ake b'yado milasos hatov v'hara. And I'm just going to hold off in 1 minute in translating that. And before we do, let's say we had a given operating definition of free will. So what would your operating definition of free will be?
Ability to choose.
Right? The ability to choose. That if you tell me that this is right and this is wrong, so that we have the ability to opt for either. We have the ability to opt for what's good. We have the ability, Rahman al-Islam, to opt for the other path. Is that what the Rambam says here? Is that the Rambam's working definition of the chiyuch of free will? Well, the Rambam has a much deeper and much more profound definition. So maybe let's reread this line and we'll translate it this time. Ein min sheni doma lo bazeha inyan. There is no comparable creature here in the world. Sheyehehu me'atzmo, he me'atzmo, of his own accord. Bedaito, with his understanding, ubimachshavto, and through his thought, yodeya hatov v'hara, he can know, he can divine, he can understand, he can distinguish good from bad, v'ose kol mashehu chafetz, and can then do whatever he chooses to do. V'ein misha ya'akev v'yodo, and no one holds him back, no one interferes with that freedom of choice. Milasos hatov v'hara. So the Rambam's definition is a much deeper definition. The Rambam's definition, did anyone pick it up, I will say? Well, what did the Rambam add to our, I think what most people would give as the working definition of free will? That I can choose to do A, I can choose to do B. And what does the Rambam add to it, I will say? Okay, he's underscoring the fact that there is no one's going to interfere, correct?
Specifically with good and evil.
But specifically, that the Rambam tells us that part of the same capacity of free will is the capacity to discern good from bad. In other words, we would have, I think, define free will as, if you tell me, if you teach me what's good and what's bad, okay, so now, equipped with that knowledge, so now I have the free will to choose to do what's good, or Rahman al-Islam, to make the other choice. The Rambam says, no, part of that capacity with which HaKadosh Baruch Hu endowed us is not only the freedom to choose, but the ability to discern on our own and to distinguish and to recognize and to discriminate right from wrong. And then, with that, again, knowledge that we're as part of that same capacity, now we can act on that and we can choose which to do. Again, just to reread that line. Sheyehehu me'atzmo, it's the third line there in Halacha Aleph, he himself, of his own accord, bedaita, with his understanding, ubemachshavto, again, through his thought, through his reflection, he is yodea tov v'ra. That the person has the ability to understand and to recognize what's right and what's wrong, and then to choose to act on it. The autonomy which free will gives a person, in the Rambam's understanding, is tremendously magnified. Because it's not only an autonomy of choice, but it's also an autonomy which includes the ability to recognize and to discern what's right from what's wrong. Not only that we have the moral autonomy when given choice and having the choices explained to us, that we have that autonomy to choose, but the autonomy of Bechira Chavshis in the Rambam's understanding is that we have the ability, again, to discern it in the first place, to discern right from wrong, and that we're not, again, not totally passive in terms of being in a position to correctly exercise our Bechira Chavshis. Now, it might very well be, and I apologize, you don't have this source in front of you, I'm just going to read you a couple of lines. It could be that for the Rambam, that this is part of a his overall conception of man. The Rambam, the very first chapter in the Rambam's Maor Nevuchim, so the Rambam talks about what does it mean that we're created with B'Tzelem Elokim. So the Rambam says there are people who erroneously understand that Tzelem implies physical image, and therefore they had a, Rachman al-Etzlan, a corporeal understanding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Rambam says if you want to talk about physical image, so then the word in Hebrew is toar. You don't use tzelem for that. The word is as in yefei toar v'yefei ma'ariv. But tzelem implies a spiritual abstract quality. It doesn't imply something physical, but something abstract. In an abstract sense, we're b'tzelem Elokim. And what is it referred to specifically? So the Rambam says that the Tzelem Elokim of a person is his essence, and what that is in terms of a person is Asher bo tihiya ha-hasaga ha-enoshis u-biglal ha-hasaga ha-sichlis hazo ne'emar bo b'Tzelem Elokim bara osa. That what it means that we're created in the image of God. So according to the Rambam's understanding, in the image of God means that we have this intellectual capacity. And it's probably, arguably, this understanding of Tzelem Elokim which underlies the Rambam's definition and understanding of free will. Again, that the free will is not only, again, autonomy in making choices, but even the autonomy to be able to discover and recognize and appreciate truth, and to be able to discriminate right from wrong. It places an even greater degree of responsibility upon a person than the more limited conventional understanding of free will. If no one ever told me what's right and what's wrong, so what do you expect me to do with my free will? But according to the Rambam, part of that capacity for free will is that we have the ability to recognize and to discern and to discover on our own what's right and what's wrong. And it, again, it heightens the degree of responsibility.
Isn't the Rambam the guy talking about you use truth and good, right? Those are two different dimensions to the Rambam.
So
how does truth affect good or evil? The Eitz HaDaat Tov HaRa is a call of man. Truth is one thing.
It's not clear that in this halacha in Hilchos Tshuva that the Rambam is using Tov and Ra the same way. Without getting sidetracked too much, I'm not sure that the way the Rambam is using the pasuk here of Ladas Tov Ra is the same as the way he understands it in the Moreh. Because over here, he clearly is describing Tov Ra as from the time Adam was first created. Whereas in the Moreh, he understands that that's something that happened after the Chet. So I don't think it's of one, it's not a miksha akas, anyway. Before continuing with the Rambam, for a minute, again, to further flesh out just the scope of Bechira Chofshes, I don't think you have this in the sheet in front of you, but let's review for a minute a very famous comment of the Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra addresses what already in his day was a well-known question. Oh, it is his? Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. On the bottom, thank you very much. The bottom of the third side that you have, Ibn Ezra al-Shmos Parakhov Pasa Gidalid. We'll read a couple of lines together in a minute just to give the background to the question. Ibn Ezra refers to the famous question in terms of the last of the Asaras HaDibros, how can the Torah say Lo Sachmo, not to covet? Coveting, again, is not only an emotional response, but the truth is it can be an instinctive response. Imagine the following scenario. Imagine that it's a little harder to imagine this in Eretz Yisrael, it's a little easier in Chutz La'aretz, but imagine that it's a frigid, cold day, sub-zero temperatures. You have someone, Rachman Litzlan, who's homeless, he's so impoverished, he doesn't even have a proper coat, hasn't had a square meal in days. And he's walking alongside a house, and he looks inside the house, and he sees it's lit, and he sees that the fireplace, there's a beautiful fire going, and it's warm, and he sees all kinds of delicacies to eat on the table. So in that situation, a person doesn't make a premeditated decision that he's going to covet. I think we would describe his reaction as it's an instinctive reaction. Just he finds himself coveting. So that's the question. So how can the Torah regulate instincts? That the Torah can regulate actions, we understand, but how does the Torah regulate instincts? So let's take a look at the Ibn Ezra. Lo sachmod, anoshim rabim yismahu alzosa mitzvah. Many people are perplexed by this mitzvah. You see it, Rabbi? So it's the last source that you have here. Eich yia odam shlo yachmod dove yofer belibo kol mashu nachmod amare einav. How can a person not react that way? Again, it's an instinctive reaction. Va'ata etein lechol moshel. I'll give you a moshel. I'll give you the following parable. Da ki ish kfori, a villager, sheyesh lo das nechana, who's in his right mind, v'hu ra'a bas melech shehi yafa, he sees a princess, a beautiful princess, lo yachmod osa b'libo sheyishka avima, he doesn't aspire to marry her, ki yeda ki ze lo yitache, because he knows that it's absolutely crazy, he knows that the king is not going to marry off his daughter, the princess, to some crude villager. So he doesn't, and for this villager to want to marry the princess, he'd have to be ke'echa min hamishugon, he'd have to be out of his mind, says the Ibn Ezra. So that's his mashal. So how does that answer the question? Right. So he goes on and he explains, well, the nimshal is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu apportions to everyone what he's supposed to have, and a person can't have, and what's more, shouldn't have, what HaKadosh Baruch Hu hasn't apportioned to him. The same way the villager understands that he's never going to marry the princess, so too we should recognize that if HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave that house to our neighbor and not to us, it's for him, it's not for us, it ain't going to happen. That's what the Ibn Ezra says. But how does that answer the question? Again, in fleshing out the Ibn Ezra's question, so we said that when a person covets, it's an instinctive reaction. It's not he doesn't stop and deliberate and think, should I covet, shouldn't I covet? It's an instinctive reaction. So what this Ibn Ezra is telling us, again, something which has tremendous bearing and relevance to our topic of Bechira Chafshis, is that the Torah expects us, the fundamentals of our belief system is not only something that we're supposed to be able to intellectually subscribe to, that if a questionnaire is passed around, so do you believe in divine providence? Do you believe in God? Check the yes box. Do you believe in divine providence? Yes. And we check it all off. What the Torah expects is that a person should so internalize those fundamental beliefs that his very reactions are conditioned by those beliefs. Let's say the following, just to concretize what we're talking about. The Sefer HaChinuch that you have here talks about this as well. I think the Sefer HaChinuch is here. Yeah, on the second side. If you take a look, you see in the second side where we're Sefer HaChinuch Mitzvah Resh Mem Aleph. So the structure of the Sefer HaChinuch is a listing of the 613 mitzvahs, and the structure of the Sefer HaChinuch is the opening paragraph sort of gives you a definition, a working definition of the mitzvah. Then there's a paragraph which engages in Tamei mitzvahs, where the Sefer HaChinuch gives a reason for the mitzvahs. Then he gives us some of the dinim, some of the relevant halachas of the mitzvah. So let's take a look here how the Sefer HaChinuch explains the Shor Shei HaMitzvah, the reason for the mitzvah of not taking revenge. So how would we explain why the Torah prohibits taking revenge? What would our explanation for that be, Rabbi Yossi?
It's a societal issue.
I think the Rambam actually writes that in Hilchos Deyos. It will destroy the fabric of society. How else would we explain it?
It's irrational.
Why is it irrational?
I mean, you're basing an action out of feeling. There is no real.
But why is it irrational? If you did bad to me, so why is it irrational that I want to do bad to you? It makes perfect sense to me.
We'll stop.
No, you're right. Don't back down. You're right. But you have to. I have to figure out why you're right, but you're right.
Maybe just because someone else broke the law doesn't mean you should go ahead and break the law also. It's not like a reason.
Correct, but we're trying to figure out why there is such a law. Right, so we have to try to figure out why there is such a law.
To avoid people taking justice into their own hands?
Right, I think we would give all these answers. We would say it's a very bad midah, it's a very bad character trait.
It's an action grounded in instinct, and the Torah is trying to remove
it. I'm sorry, it's not?
It's an action grounded in instinct, and the Torah is trying to remove man from instinct.
I think all of these are great answers. Now let's take a look, and they're all true, they're all correct. Take a look at what the Sefer HaChinuch says. Mishor Shei HaMitzvah, you see it, Rabbi Yossi, again, it's here on the second side. Sheyeda ha'odam v'yitein alibo. A person should know, we'll come back in a minute, Lina, to translate the other phrase. Sheyeda ha'odam ki kol ashe yekrehu mitov adra. This is represents this. Thank you very much. this represents the Sefer HaChinuch's understanding of the all-encompassing nature of divine providence. Ki kol asher yekrehu mitov ad ra, anything that befalls a person from good to bad, husiba shatova ola me'es Hashem Baruch Hu, is something which is ultimately caused by Hashem. Umiyad ha'odam miyad isha achiv, from the hands of one's fellow man, according to the Sefer HaChinuch, lo yihi adava bilti ritzon Hashem Baruch Hu. Nothing can happen unless Hashem signs off on it. Al kain, consequently, kisha yitza arehu o yach ivehu adam, if a person causes him distress or inflicts pain, yeda benafsho, a person should know that avonosov garmu v'Hashem yizbarach gazal v'chach, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu decreed that this should happen. And therefore, lo yoshes machshevosov linko mimenu, ki hu eino sibas ra'aso. He shouldn't, therefore, think how to take revenge, because... So, what's your name?
Michael.
So what Michael said, it's irrational, but you know why it's irrational? Because according to the Sefer HaChinuch, to seek revenge represents a tremendous theological blunder. Because if I'm looking to take revenge, it means that I think that you're the cause of what happened to me. In reality, says the Sefer HaChinuch, given again his all-encompassing understanding of divine providence, one person's, and this also brings us to another important element of our topic, one person's free will cannot impact another person unless Hashem signs off on it. If I choose to swing a right and try to punch this young man in the nose, either I'm going to miss, or if I hit, it means that for some reason Hashem wants him to endure. Have your arm up in the back. Okay. Hashem wants him to endure that pain. That being the case, just 1 minute. That being the case, so the Sefer HaChinuch says to seek revenge is something again which is theologically wrong, not just morally wrong, not just moral corruption, but theologically it's wrong, because in seeking revenge, it's as if I view the other person as the cause of what happened, and the other person is never, ever the cause. I'm just going to hold up just 1 minute, just tie this back in with Ibn Ezra, and then we'll just stop for the questions for a moment. Now, what the Ibn Ezra is saying is, so the point of this Sefer HaChinuch is that the connection in Yahadus between what we believe and what we do and what we think is much closer than we realize. That belief and behavior, if a person really believes in divine providence, so then according to the Sefer HaChinuch, if a person really believes it, so then a person doesn't seek revenge. Because to seek revenge contradicts belief in divine providence. Now notice, go back for 1 minute please, Rabbi Bosa, to that first line of the Sefer HaChinuch. Mishor she'a mitzvah she'yeda ha'odam. What are the next three words? Someone want to read them? V'yitein aliba. What does v'yitein aliba mean?
Internalize.
Exactly. He should take to heart. He should internalize. It's not enough to know. It's not enough to believe. A person has to internalize. If a person internalizes his belief in divine providence, that undercuts any desire for revenge. Coming back to the Ibn Ezra, so we asked, how did the Ibn Ezra respond to his question? He gave us this whole mashal with a villager, and no villager in his right mind is going to want to marry the princess. So what's that going to do with my instinctive reaction walking in the street, the instinctive reaction of this poor, homeless, starving person? How does he not instinctively covet? The answer is, if a person internalizes beliefs, so even things that we label as instincts, a person through his own bechira chofshes molds those instincts. We're not talking about an instinct to covet. It's not like the instinct when the doctor takes the hammer and then bangs you on the bottom of your foot or something, and your foot kicks out. We're not talking about an instinctive reflexive reaction. The type of instinct of coveting is an instinct which really, really reflects belief. If I believe that I could have what Hashem gave to the other person, so then I instinctively covet. But if I believe and have internalized the belief that I can't have what Hashem vouchsafes for someone else, what Hashem has given a portion to someone else is not to be had by me, so then if I not only know that, Shiyeda Ha'odam, but the operative phrase, Yiten Alibo, so then through that, again, act of Bechir Chavshis, I create my instincts. And that's how the Torah can expect us, again, that even our instinctive reactions will be in line with the Torah's expectations. Okay, so maybe there were a couple of questions, so please.
So why shouldn't I try to take revenge? Because if I succeed, then it means that God wanted me to succeed.
Okay, so that's a great question. And maybe let's even magnify your question. So why is it then that we should we not react with outrage when people perpetrate violence? Because it couldn't have happened if Hashem hadn't signed off on it. So why do we think that all the evil people in the world, because of all the wickedness, why do we condemn them? So, Moshe, it's a great question. So, Moshe the Mount of Adome. Let me give you the following, Moshe. Let's say you have a person, Rachman al-Atslan, a very, very severe case of diabetes. And Rachman al-Atslan, the doctors can't control it. That they say that there's gangrene on a limb, that a limb has to be amputated. Rachman al-Atslan, it's the only way to save his life. Okay. And then you have this crazed drug addict. He's, again, he's totally out of control, and he's running around with a sword. And it just so happens that he, again, crazed drug addict, right? And he knows when he takes the drugs what drugs do to a person. And he does it anyway. And this crazed drug addict, and he comes running in with a sword, and it just so happens that he strikes the person and severs the limb exactly where the limb was supposed to be severed. So is he a hero? What's our attitude towards this crazed drug addict? He's horrible, he's evil, he's wicked. The fact why, let's say a surgeon would wash his hands and scrub, and then surgically make an incision in the exact same place. See, he'd be a hero. What's the difference? Why is one a hero and why is one evil? The surgeon knows that this is supposed to be done, and that it's supposed to be done for a good and noble purpose, and that's why he's doing it. The crazed drug addict, he wasn't given any kind of prophecy or even medical report that says that this person needs an amputation. He's acting on a violent impulse. He's acting on a violent impulse of his own accord, so then he is totally, 100% morally responsible. The fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, from a totally different perspective, has a totally different reason for allowing that to happen, a reason which is probably totally inscrutable to us, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu intends it letovo. God intends it for good. This person, he didn't receive a prophecy. He doesn't. He's acting the person who goes ahead. So that would be the answer to your question in terms of seeking revenge also. If I'm a Novi and Hashem tells me, you know what, that guy deserves to be punished for what he did to you, so then it would be a very noble thing for me to do it. But given the fact that I don't have nevuah, so then for me to try to take revenge would be like the crazed drug addict. And even if Hashem lets it happen, doesn't mean that that he wanted me to do it, and it doesn't justify my actions morally.
In the first Rambam, Hilchot Shuvah Perakei on Halacha Aleph, you talked about this universal understanding of good and bad, and we see in different cultures and different societies that people have different understandings of good and bad. So how would he reconcile that? We have this the ability to discern that goodness versus bad.
That's also an excellent question. So I think what the Rambam would tell us a person can have the ability, but there's a lot that can go wrong in exercising that ability and in applying it. And maybe that's how the Rambam would understand the famous Midrashic account with which you're all familiar, about how when Hashem was ready to give the Torah, how he offers it to different nations of the world, and they ask what's in the Torah, don't murder, don't steal, no, we're not ready for that, we're not ready for that, is that people's judgments can be influenced by all types of all types of vested interests, all types of subjectivity. If a person can transcend that and recognize truth, or a person can allow his judgment to be impaired. And I think what the Rambam would say, I think he would insist that if people would really exert themselves to transcend all these types of vested interests and subjectivities, that people can recognize truth. I think the Rambam would insist that is the case.
So everyone, whether they're in the most disgusting, perverse society, and that's the norm, and they look at that as good, has the ability to be an iconoclast and just break that off?
I think the Rambam's answer to that is an emphatic yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. Firstly, couldn't you, since the Rambam is going to, essentially, this is an introduction to the issue of virtue, right? Deot is virtue. And the Rambam believes that Deot, what is the virtue, can be established universally. In other words, it follows Aristotle in that. And that should make a difference whether you're in this society or that society. Reason should lead you to a position of virtue.
With regard to your answer earlier to Jeremy's question, it still seems that if our assumption is that anything bad that happens to a person is inherently right, and that even if someone attacks someone else or hits someone else, that pain they feel is what is intrinsically what God wanted. Doesn't that open the door to what took place, I think, like in the Dark Ages? It takes place, I think, in some Muslim societies where various social services and things like this are not provided, because the assumption is if something bad has happened to you, you deserved it and you should live with the consequences. How do you draw the line between?
So that's also an excellent question. I think Tosfos in Bava Kamma comments that the Gemara has also a very famous drasha in the context of talking about the liability if one person attacks another person and inflicts bodily harm. So the Torah says that there are five different aspects to his liability. If he cripples the person, so he has to compensate him for that. If he causes the person to be unemployed for a while, he has to compensate him for that. He has to compensate him for the pain that he inflicted. He has to compensate him for whatever shame or humiliation accompanied it. But then he also has to pay the doctor's bills. And the Torah says, "Verapo yirape." The assailant has to pay the doctor bills. And the Gemara comments on that in Brachos and Bava Kamma, in a few places, the Gemara comments on Verapa Yerape, Mikan Shenitna Rishus, the Rofe Lerapas. That from here we see that rishus, permission, is given for the doctor to engage in medical treatment and to do his best to heal the patient. So I think there's a little Tosfos in Bava Kamma where they comment and say that what the Torah is, the reason you need the Torah to tell us this is that without such a pasuk, so one could have embraced a Christian Science position and said that all type of medical intervention is an attempt to subvert what Hashem has decreed. And the Torah tells us not like that. The Torah tells us that the same way we're asked and expected to engage in human initiative in other realms, here too, the fact that it comes from Hashem notwithstanding, but once given from Hashem, so Hashem says, now that's part of your challenge to deal with and to try to overcome. And that's exactly what the Torah teaches us in that phrase, Virapa Yirape, and that's how we know not to adopt that position.
How do you incorporate the Sefer Phoenix view with regard to something like the Holocaust?
So you're touching on the very, very important, and so I'm going to answer straight, but I ask that people should listen very, very carefully. You have to hear all. Either don't listen at all or listen to everything. Don't listen to half of what I'm going to say. So either fall asleep now or wait until later fall asleep. But don't fall asleep in the middle. Sefer HaChinuch isn't explaining to us the issue of theodicy. Sefer HaChinuch is not telling us that we are in a position to understand why HaKadosh Baruch Hu does what he does. The reason the Sefer HaChinuch is not attempting to do that is immediately apparent. There's a big mistake that is often made in thinking about thinking of, let's say, about the Holocaust in particular, and the mistake is methodological, meaning the following. People say, look, the Holocaust happened, how can a person believe in divine providence given the Holocaust? The correct approach is the following. The correct approach is, before looking at any event in history, even the Holocaust, so a person is supposed to ask philosophically, what are our expectations in terms of understanding divine providence? Can we expect to understand everything God does or not? So the answer to that is clearly what? The mashal, again, take the following mashal. Let's say you have a parent, a new parent, took lots of classes in parenting, believes in a lot of communication with his children, so he's going to be very open with his children. So he's not going to do anything for his children that his children can't understand. Okay, fine. So his baby is 3 months old. The baby is supposed to get inoculated against chickenpox, and against the whooping cough, and against mumps, and the rubella, and measles. But his 3-month-old won't understand why he should go to the doctor and get stuck in the arm multiple times. So the parent is not going to do it. So what would we say? That this is a kind and benevolent parent? We would say no. We would say that if anything, he's guilty of child neglect. Because what kind of mishigas, what kind of craziness is it that a parent limits himself to parenting on a level that an infant or a little child can understand? Obviously, the parent has to parent on his level to the best of his or her understanding. So the same thing, that we should have an a priori expectation to understand what Hashem does in the world, is as absurd, right? When you stop and think about it, as expecting that the three-month-old infant should be able to understand everything that his or her parents are doing. So we obviously recognize that for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to act as HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of course there are going to be things that are inscrutable and that are totally beyond us. The Sefer HaChinuch is just telling us, not that he's not saying that I can explain to you why everything happens. He's not telling you that I can that we can ever rise and share Hashem's vantage point to see why what happens has to happen. What he's saying is that what happens is not accidental, and that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, from his vantage point, has a perfectly just reason for everything that happens. It's something, it's a vantage point that we can't share. And because of that, so we accept his will the same way. If the child has enough sense, he trusts his parents as well. Is that clear? Okay, maybe we'll should we go on a little bit, a few more minutes here? Okay, so first we spoke about the Rambam's broad definition of Bechira Chofshis, and again, that it's not only moral autonomy to choose, but it's the moral autonomy to recognize and discern right and wrong. We saw the Ibn Ezra, again, also in terms of just how empowered we are by our Bechira Chofshis, even things that we label as instinctive reactions really depend on how we condition ourselves and with what beliefs we condition ourselves. And then we also, apropos of looking at the Sefer HaChinuch, we touched upon another fundamental question. We didn't necessarily review all the opinions on the subject, but at least we saw the Sefer HaChinuch's opinion that one person's free will cannot impact another person unless Hashem approves of what's going to happen. So maybe just we'll touch on one more point, possibly two more points as time allows. Take a look at the Halacha Gimel here, back to the first sheet of Elsai. Tov ze ikar gadol hu, v'hu amud ha-Torah v'ha-Mitzvah. This principle of free will is the foundation and the pillar which upholds all of Torah and the very notion of having mitzvahs, of having commandments. Here, I'll just throw out a question you can think about, work on, and not maybe some other time we can discuss a possible answer. The Rambam here, by association, triggers a very fascinating question. Anyone remember offhand what the Rambam's 13 principles of faith are? Anyone remember them? What they are?
He doesn't have Bechir
Chofshis.
It's missing.
Bechir Chofshis, okay. So take a shortcut. Bechir Chofshis is not amongst the is not amongst the 13. Maybe we'll digress for a minute and discuss what those 13 principles of faith are. That they're in the Siddur, in davening twice every morning. You have it in Yigdal, in poetry, and then you have the Ani Ma'amins in prose, printed at the end of Shachrus, right? So the first one is belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu as the source of all existence. The second one is the uniqueness and unity of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The third one is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is incorporeal. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has no body. The fourth is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu alone is eternal. Hu Rishon VaAchron, HaKadosh Baruch Hu alone is eternal. The fifth is that we relate directly to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, no intermediaries. That's usually identified as the first grouping within the 13 principles of faith. The next four have to do with prophecy and Torah, that there is prophecy, that within prophecy, that Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy was unique, that we have the Torah today that was given to Moshe Rabbeinu, and that Torah is immutable. Torah is eternal. Torah is not going to change. Those are numbers 6, 7, 8, and 9. And the last four have to do with the reward and punishment, divine providence. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows everything that happens. Number 10, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu rewards and Rahman al-Slan punishes as our person's just deserts. Number 12 is that Mashiach comes. And 13 is bodily resurrection. Tchiyas HaMeitim. One of them is a little bit hard to find in Yigdal. When you daven tomorrow morning after Adon Olam, you say Yigdal, one of them is 12 of them are very obvious in Yigdal, one of them is a little bit subtle. So you'll have to look to find one of them in Yigdal. But it is a fascinating question, which we're not going to touch upon now. So what's your name?
Joshua.
Which Joshua mentioned, why isn't, as the Rambam here says, Bechira Chavshis is the foundation of all of Torah, how come the Rambam didn't include it in the 13 principles of faith? Okay, it's an interesting interesting question to think about. At any rate, that's what the Rambam says, that and he goes on to elaborate that it's nonsensical to command, it's nonsensical to reward and punish unless a person has free will.
Isn't the whole premise of you have to give them free, and people say that you have mitzvot, but you can't have mitzvot, believe in God. Ram will call it that Elohim as opposed to and then I'm Elohim, that'll be Gimel Krim, because from mitzvot, you need to believe in God before you have mitzvot. Maybe the Gimel Krim, the practice that you have to believe in the Kashmir Sheikh, otherwise the point of commanding to believe X, Y, and Z, if you don't believe, you have a choice of what to believe and what not to believe. So it goes above the Gimel.
Maybe it's axiomatic. Meaning it could be. That's an excellent suggestion. Excellent, excellent suggestion. Okay, there are other topics here, but rather than rush through them, I don't know, maybe you can discuss them with your Rebbeim. The Rambam treats the famous question about human free will versus divine foreknowledge. You have it here, but it's not something that we can rush, so maybe I leave it to your study together with your Rebbeim.